In our study on the Sermon on the Mount, we were working in this general area. I got busy constructing these things on the overhead because I thought that better and I like to do it better. See, I have this overhead scooting around here in several directions. There's nothing like being blunt with these, isn't it? Some of the bio-life.
Yes. Is that going to be one of the things you can add to us?
No. What's that?
There's no more handouts.
That's right.
9 and 10 are the last one. 7 is the last one. 9 and 10 are the last one. The handouts end with 9 and 10. Maybe in another year, there's 1, 11, or 12. Well, I don't really know because it's collective. I may not teach it again for 20 years. It's going to make a big solace and have a great block to go over and aggravate your soul. But I will pretty sharply keep you posted by the overhead what I'm doing, so you don't let that go off.
So there are Roman numeral 6, the particular studies in the sermon. How many remember that there's a test on Friday in this course? Yeah, good. It's scheduled on a thing. Yeah, that's right. Remember, I gave you a schedule at the start of the year to install things we're doing. Yep. Calls for it on the 31st, and on a note it says, I know this is early, but we'll get it over with before the big rush. That's exactly what it says. And it mentioned that those who are working in the Greek section, those who are working in the Greek section, are accountable for Matthew 5 at the time of that test. It's on the page that gives the assignments, tells you what to do, papers to read, MDiv students. All those students, the mid-semester examination will be March 31st. That's early, but it will beat the rush. You'll be accountable for all classwork, and the MDiv people will be accountable for the Greek of Matthew 5. So I'm going to remind you.
There'll be more than the Greek of Matthew 5, right?
Yeah, but no more Greek than that. All the Greek will be in Matthew 5. Let's do Friday.
Talking parsing.
I don't often ask. I might ask the verb. I'm much more likely to say, what is the syntactical use of the stated phrase? A lot of times you can't answer that definitively, so you say, I think it is this. And then I don't say, I think you're wrong, unless you say, what dated phrase? Once in a while, there's a key word that needs parsing, but I'm not big on that.
So you'll show the Greek text?
Yes, I'll show you some Greek text. But that's Friday. I'll take probably the first hour of that Friday, second hour, because Friday's our two-hour day. Second hour, we'll come back and study the sermon, like I'm going to do today in these couple minutes. That's Friday. Okay? March the 31st. It's early, but it beats the rush. And the way things have gone for us, we better beat all the rushes we can. So I mentioned the particular divisions in our last class. I've actually written some of these on the blackboard because of my laziness. I hadn't copied this from my notes. I mentioned the division of the sermon. There's four major categories, as far as I'm concerned. Now, you're free to study and make your own divisions. You have an outline to prepare for me. If your divisions don't accord with mine, that's not a matter of life or death. But when I'm working to present the stuff in class, then I've got to have something to say, so I follow mine. So in capital B, division on the first section, which is the Lord's people, which covers 5, 1 through 12. And I think I showed you in a quick form this overhead chart of mine, this analytical type chart, which in an inductive way tries to take the whole of verses 1 through 20 in an inductive way to show the state of the Lord's people, to show their condition, to show the things that are promised to them. The idea is simply getting an idea of the Lord's people in their context in the world where we live, how they are blessed, how they are useful, how they are taught well. You see, the funny thing is that we often think of blessing in terms of material well-being and things related to it. I'm not saying it's not that. But, somebody will say, I owed the comptroller's office $5,000. I got a great blessing. Somebody gave me 6. This is not a class for fault finding. This is just a class for talking things up. We often say that, but when you say, how are they blessed, the Lord's people blessed, practically none of the blessednesses of it relate to material well-being. Practically none of them do, or to physical well-being. We can't dismiss the whole thing like that.
And because this isn't the total teaching, this would have to be put into context of the Old New Testament. But in this passage, the blessings are related, not the thing. Mr. Garrish.
I don't want to counter do what you just kind of think, but you had a third column there.
Yes.
And put a how.
Yes.
And how.
Except the how isn't in the text.
Right.
See, all of these are in the text.
Yeah.
You could, and there, I wouldn't argue with that, except you have to make that distinction. How this is done to them is not in the text, but this much is in the text. And that's what the analytical inductive chart tries to do. It tries to rewrite the text, not to correct it or change it, but tries to recreate the text in meaningful categories. And of course, if you wrote the how, then you'd have to go to many other passages of Scripture to see, well, to see the how. And you might find some real material things in it too. But my guess is you'd not find as many as you might. I don't mean you personally. I mean the average person would find as many as might think. But we often get that the cart twisted. I'm greatly blessed today my car started. I heard a fellow give a lecture on blessings last summer, and he limited the word blessing so much that practically nobody had ever been blessed. I'm not listed that way. You know, some people say it can't relate to material things. Well, I think that's crazy. In my mind, blessing is when you're given something beyond your normal purview by a superior person. It can be one of several lives. But when I look over the Lord's people, I discover them saying, well, what are they blessed? Here are the conditions that relate to their blessing. The particular promises that come with those conditions, they're blessed in the fact that they're granted these things and promises by God. Now, the second and third categories are a little more arbitrary in some way, but the guy who makes the chart has a right to be arbitrary as long as he's nice. So we say they are useful when they serve as salt and as light and honoring God's word. That's when they're useful. When the people of God are not serving as salt or light or praising God, then from a pragmatic point of view, they're not useful. You don't light a lamp and put it under a bushel, it's not useful. You don't take salt and contaminate it by allowing natural elements to ruin the calcium content of it. I'm not an expert on salt, but I can tell you what happens to salt that's left exposed to moisture for a long time. I know it from making ice cream. If salt is exposed to moisture for a long time, there's a chemical reaction that kills the calcium falling to the salt, and the salt will not melt ice anymore. We just have to take my word for that or try it sometimes. You make ice cream by putting it in a bucket and turning it round and round with ice all around it, and you pour a lot of salt to melt the ice, and if the ice doesn't melt, the cream won't get cold enough and you'll never get ice cream, you'll turn your arm off. So all you have to do is use some salt sometime that has sat on the floor of the fruit cellar all winter and has absorbed a great deal of moisture, and you discover that that moisture is made a chemical imbalance that will melt the ice. Ergo, it's worthless. So the Lord's people are useful when they are serving the salt, or when they are salty, and when they are lighting and honoring, is my word in verse 15, because they're glorifying God in that sense. And then they are taught well, and again in my discussion, when they honor His word. Don't think I've come to destroy it. When they honor His word, when they keep it, and when they do it, because unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you really have no standing with God. So in a sense, you see, I think there is a skeleton form for describing the character of the Lord's people as the Lord spoke them on the mount. It doesn't tell everything. It can't tell everything. The whole Bible is required to tell everything. But it gives you a synopsis on Jesus' teaching with regard to His people. Now, to get a full synopsis of it, you need to go back and think of the parallel concepts in Luke and whatnot. But as I said here one day, I don't think the Lucan situation was given at the same time under the same context. I think the Lord gave these teachings many times, many times. I can't believe that He just sat down once, said these few verses, and never said them again. I think He said them many times. And so consequently, I think the setting in Luke 6 in particular is a different setting, much the same material, because God's people have to hear the same material lots of times before it sticks in their skull. Yes?
I'm just asking this. I watched the Ten Commandments, I think, and it has nothing to do with it.
Yes.
Well, what do you do when, in Luke, it's different from Matthew, and even in other cases, similar amount of distances, where the corn of spirit, their promise, is something different than a different camp?
Oh, yes. You remember in Luke, it's not poor in spirit, it's just the poor, isn't it? I'm not going to fight a thorough issue over two words, but here's the funny thing. There's a great amount of truth to be taught. about the poor and various other great amount of truths to be taught, said in many different ways. And I would be amazed if every time the Lord spoke on the subject, he said exactly the same words, because there are many other aspects to be taught about it. So if I remember rightly, in Luke, the words in spirit do not occur. And I'm going to press here that the poor in spirit is not just the guy with no money in his pocket when I get to that. But in Luke, I'm going to, if we get to Luke, it's outside Matthew. If we get to Luke, there I'm going to press that the poor are those people who are sociologically, economically disadvantaged to a large extent. And hence, he doesn't use poor in spirit. He's not exactly talking about a different group, but a subdivision of the group or something like that. I think that the only time you'll have a problem would be if the Lord said, blessed are the poor in spirit, because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then somewhere else he said, blessed are the poor in spirit, because they're not going to heaven. Then I think you'd have trouble. You'd have some problem. Probably figure out some way to handle that. But unless you have a sharp dichotomy, I think then you have what we would call complementary teachings of the Lord on a particular subject.
Or if they're completely different ideas, they say, the poor in spirit,
they should have. That's right. That's exactly right. No reason to limit what the Lord is doing and what he's saying. But in my mind, getting the grip on how Christ teaches is the big thing. Now, none of us can know that fully, but we read through the New Testament. I just said it, so I shouldn't say it again. We can't grip it fully, but we discover that the Lord teaches. Sometimes he asks questions. Sometimes he just lays it on the line. Sometimes he debates. Sometimes he reads their mind and then says, you're not thinking right. He does all those things the Lord does. So any teacher who's thinking about communication finds many ways to communicate his message to his group. And he also knows that on any one discourse, he doesn't cover every aspect that they need to know. So he finds ways of adding points here and there. And there's really no problem with that, unless when he adds point two, it's an absolute direct contradiction of point one, then it's bad news. We don't have that in the Gospels. I think we have supplementary materials in other contexts, other ideas, expanded ideas in the Gospels. And I think they reach out well. So what I create or try to draw is this overall chart. That's not the kind of thing I'm asking you to draw, but that's the kind of thing I draw. I spend a lot of time working on stuff like that in my study for a biblical book, so I probably would never have to use it on anything. But it's good for me. It's good for me to study. And a lot of times you get it out and you think you'll use it in church somewhere. I don't mind showing a class what I think is an inductive study or a thing, but in the average church situation, it is inexplicable. Might just as well forget it. Maybe you can boil it down to 4 points. Now, if you've got a study group in your home, that's a little different matter, too. But I do it for me, and it works out well for me. I don't learn everything, but I learn a little bit by it. I learned that the Lord shows a fulfilled life and true happiness, usefulness, understanding, and that emphasis is both doing and being, and the Christian character is full of traits and compass, all of these lifestyles, things along that line. And yet when I'm done with that, I come back to this concept of the analogy of faith, and I say this has to be studied in the light of the epistles, the Old Testament. It's all going to be studied in the light of that. You can't take out these 5 or 6 things and say that's all there is to it. What you can say is that they are the points stressed in the Sermon on the Mount. And if you make that the end of your study, then you simply have, in a nice way, you've simply blown it, that's all. Any questions there? Don't wrap around me. These things got enough electric in them. They almost grab you like an eel. So I make that breakdown into 5, 1 through 12, and the ways in which they are blessed, and then 14, 13 through 16, and how they're useful, and then 17 through 20 with regard to how they are taught. Well, then let's go and look at the Beatitudes. Let's go and look at them. It'd be good if I opened my Bible. I'm allowed to do it in this class. Let's go and look at the Beatitudes and just talk about them for a few minutes, one with another. Oh, yeah. I still want to spell with 2 T's all the time. And that's because I want to make it the word, I want to make it be attitudes. You know, that's why I spell with 2 T's. Can you see that? But that's really not what it is. It's taken as a Latinization out of the word for blessed, and it means the blessednesses or the blessed state. And if I keep trying to take it out of the word for attitude, I will misspell it for the rest of my life. And that probably is what will happen, because the tailors learn very slowly, if indeed they are able to learn at all. Well,
Here again I have an idea. You'll discover that I have almost no original idea. Somebody else had it first. But conveniently, I always forget it whose it was, so I don't have to credit it with it, and I can act as if it's my idea. I have an idea that the structure of the Beatitudes is fashioned after the Old Testament patterns of the collocations of numbers, the numerical collocation. I might have gotten it from Dr. Harris years ago, I'm not sure. Remember the word collocation. I'll define it in a minute. Collocation. It is a good one to fool your friends with. You have to use it just right. You don't say the collocation will be at the Smith School on December the 6th. Collocation. Collocation means a gathering together of numbers to indicate an extent without an intensity. And in the Old Testament, the best illustrations of it we found in Proverbs, where the writer says, three things are too wonderful for me, yes, four are past finding out. We call that a collocation, a gathering together of numbers to show an extent without showing intensity. And so in Proverbs you'll read, these six things does the Lord hate, yes, seven are an abomination to him. But you know, if you thought those were the only things the Lord hated, you'd miss a lot. But what the writer is really saying is that there's an almost endless number, all wickedness, there's an almost endless number of things the Lord hates. And as they go on, they are an abomination to him. But he doesn't mean that the sixth one is worse than the fifth one, or the fifth one worse than the fourth one. The Lord hates these things. He gathers the numbers together to show you the extension of them. Yes, sir?
Is that like the word of blessing? For a thousand generations.
Precisely. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers unto the 30s and 40s. Under the 30s and 40s. And those who love me. My mercies to a thousand to those who love me. Precisely so. It's a good example on a bigger number, but precisely so. You'll see a lot of times in the book of Micah, the Lord says, I will raise seven shepherds against it, yes, eight principal men against the king of Assyria. Meaning, the leadership that I will raise against the enemies of my people is heaven. And you'll see it in Amos a lot of times, for three transgressions of Damascus, yes, for four. Here's a lot of times in the Old Testament. We often don't think of it. Well, I'm suggesting, this doesn't say three or four, by the way, but I'm suggesting that you have an arrangement in which you first of all have two introductory verses, and later you have two conclusionary verses. 1 and 2 are introductory, 11 and 12 are conclusionary. And I'm suggesting that you have a 3 and 4 and a 3 and 4 in between there. And the verses 3, this is not the law of the Medes and the Persians. But if you'll notice how the verses are tied together, verses 6 and 10, I'm reading out of King James. And blessed are they, verse 6, blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Verse 10, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The concept is a passive thing that occurs to them. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness' sake. And I'm working on, I'm sorry, not righteous, just righteousness. I'm working on the concept of righteousness, hungry and thirsting for it, being persecuted for it. So I think the structure is 3, 4, and 5. Three things mark blessing, yes, fourth thing. Three things mark blessing, yes, the fourth thing marks the fullness of blessing. Three things indicate blessing, yes, the fourth thing indicates the privilege of blessing. I think that's kind of what he's saying, but that's an idea, that's an opinion of mine. And the teachers are allowed to teach their opinion as long as they don't act like they came from heaven by itself. But that's how I've always kind of enjoyed seeing it. Two verses of introduction, then a 3 and a 4, another 3 and a 4, and two verses of conclusion. And you'll notice the thing that makes the two versions of conclusion, oh, you've got Bibles. I don't know what translations you're using. Maybe some of you are using Greek. And of course, when you get about three different translations, it can kill you. But note the difference. What's the essential, Taylor question. What is one of the essential differences between verse 10 and 11? What is one of the essential differences? Read it to yourself and tell me for a minute. See, I'm putting 10 and 11, I'm putting 10 as a concluding thought, and then putting 11 and 12 as two end verses. What's Mr. Garrish?
I think there seems to be a lack of comments.
I think that probably is right, but that isn't what I'm looking for. But I think it's probably right. But I think, and that might be argued too. But see, you get into this business of reading the teacher's mind. It's really not so bad to have to do it today. You have to do it Friday. It's murder. But Mrs. Mitchell.
Verse 10 because of righteousness.
Not what I'm looking for either. Forgive me. You don't mind if I just ask you. Anybody else? There might be many differences. You can see it in the Greek easier than you can in the English. Although in English.
Those who are persecuted, you know, it doesn't say that what they're doing is because those who are persecuted by someone.
I don't know if you're close to what I want or not. What do you think I want?
I got it.
Okay.
Verse 10 says, blessed are those. Verse 11 says, blessed are you.
Yeah. See the change in person. Now, we're not going to build any theology on that, but that's kind of interesting because all the way down through verse 10, it's a third-person concept. But suddenly in verse 10, suddenly in verse 11, it moves off into a second-person concept and keeps that through verse 12. Now, what I'm saying here is, I think that everybody would think the first two verses are introductory. He went in the mouth of the prophet, said. And I think that the shift in person suggests that 11 and 12 are conclusionary verses, because here in 11 and 12, the Lord is not talking about persons theoretically present, but talking about the persons who are actually in suffering. Now the persons in 3 through 10 might have been in front of him too, but he speaks of them as they. Blessed are they, blessed are they, blessed are they. But suddenly in 11 he looks at the gang and he says, blessed are you. So I think you have a really nice structure there. I didn't draw it well in this chart. 1 and 11, either 1 and 2 should have been more in the middle, or 11 and 12 should have been the end. But I think you have the introductory verses, and then you've got a 3-4, another 3-4, and then you've got two introductory verses to seal off the unit. Now men divided the verses, we know that. So you can forget the verse numbers and say we have this sentence. It's redundant.
Interesting concept. What
leads
you to look at that?
You know, somebody probably suggested it to me, let's be honest. I don't recall who. But I spent a fair amount of time on it. You know, I write down each one of the Beatitudes, and I say, how does this one end and what is the promise? How did this one end and what is the promise? How did this one end and what is the promise? And suddenly I began to think that I saw a sequence or an order in that. In the 3 was theirs is the kingdom of heaven. 4, they will be comforted. 5, they will inherit the earth. And because isn't the right word, they hunger and thirst after righteousness, and they will be filled. The poor will get what they need. The mourners will get what they need. The meek will get what they need. And then the qualities in 7, 8, and 9, well, 7 and 8 are sure. 9, you have to twist it a little, I suppose. But the qualities in 7, 8, and 9 are the characteristics in life rather than attitudes or practices. It's not an absolute. And so I looked at that and I said, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, not that they'll be successful, but they'll be called the children of God. So I said, it looks to me as if there are three things interrupted by truth about seeking after righteousness. Righteousness only occurs in 6 and 10, but it occurs in a pattern in 6 and 10. So I said, that looks like a pattern to me, although I think Mr. Dunlap, that somebody suggested it to me. And probably when he suggested it, I said, hey, that's not right. That's the way I work. And then I probably went back to my desk and sat down and said, oh, that looks pretty good. So I'd like to think, you know, I'd like you to think that I just sat there all day looking at the Greek text and suddenly it jumped out at me. But I think the occurrence of the word righteousness was the thing that was determinative in my mind, how they would find it and how they'll be filled with it, or vice versa, how they'll be filled with it, how they'll find it. Mr. Farrell.
Yeah, you are
the first one. Este. Soon, S. That's even last. See how quickly we go back in those things. Yeah. So I've worked along those lines. And of course, S is the verb. You are humais, plural from humais. Greek is great stuff. I'm sorry, and that's verse 13. Humah, Mr. Farrell, the accusative, in verse 11. You look down and see the wrong word. See the right word in the wrong verse and give it out like it's a fact. But the pronoun is humah in verse 11 with the S, you are blessed, and the plural predicate. Yeah. I've always thought that was kind of fascinating. Now, here's the rough part. Whether that structure is right or not really doesn't affect what it teaches. It just, in my mind, makes a teaching device that helps me hang it together. But the teaching is going to be about the same, whether the structure is right or not. Because somehow, you see, and I will argue for this and talk about every form of biblical literature, and many scholars think we're crazy. Somehow, I will say that the point is not made by the structure. The structure is a device to help the student glean the teaching, but doesn't change the teaching. In other words, we could have pure prose, line on line, and the teaching would be the same. That's where we disagree with some redactionists, form critics, and others. They allow the structure to alter the form of the teaching. And they say, well, you only have this kind of structure, this kind of teaching, etc., etc. And I think that's a mistake. I think the structure is always a vehicle intended to convey the teaching, and consequently is much less significant than the teaching. But the structure alerts the student and brings the student much more awareness of what the teaching is. So here I learned the months of the year years ago when I was a kid. 30 days since September, April, June. You've seen the little fragment of Finnegan of the little boys, the Hebrew boys calendar, what calendar is it? The Gezer calendar. You've seen that thing? It's just about, you know, it's a little stone about that long, just a fragment. But it's the months of the year, which is his 2 months are barley harvest, his 2 months are wheat harvest. You haven't seen that? You need to see that sometime. It's one of the oldest fragments of Hebrew that we have, written in a square. It's about 8th, 9th century B.C. It's quite readable. If you get somebody to give you a big picture, I have this advantage. They had a big screen, and they blew up a big picture and put it on a big screen. So you could see the letters. They're old Hebrew curses. So you could see the letters quite clearly. And then you had the advantage of a teacher who'd look and say, this is calf, don't you think? Yes, that's calf. And here's Reish. Yep, there's Reish. Reading the cursive of any language, working strictly in temple with a modern Hebrew cursive, which we don't study at all. And I looked at it and hardly knew what anything was to say. It took me about half an hour to get the alphabet in mind, and then I was able to help her, and then it took me another hour to get it in mind again, and so forth. But the cursives are tough. But there's the Gezer counter. His 2 months are this, his 2 months are that, her 2 months are this. And there are about 8 months enumerated before it's broken. And we've always chuckled. We wondered if the kid broke it going to school and threw it away so his parents wouldn't find it, or if he just chucked it out and broke when he threw it. We wondered about those things in the calendar. But what I've said, I learned the poem 30 days after September. It could have been in prose, so you could have gone like this. There are 30 days in September, as every good kid knows. And what's more, there are 30 more days in October, in November, and 31 days. I could have learned it in prose. The point of it would have been exactly the same. But the poetic form was put together to help me remember it better. Are you with me on that? Don't think I'm just beating your ears. So when someone says, well, the structure of this particular thing is a poem, and poems are not intended to be understood literally, you bite your lip and you say, well, it depends what the poem says. The structure should never condition the meaning that you have. You study the thing for the meaning, and then you study the structure for the appreciation of the literature. And it will help you very much in those things. So you'll get on to chiasms and whatnot after a while, but a chiasm where you jump over a gap of stuff like that, like the dogs and the swine and the pearls and all those things, a chiasm is not intended to hurt the message. It's intended to make the message more clear by connecting things in right order together, etc. Well, I kind of like that. You're certainly not obligated to it, but I kind of like it because I close my eyes and I see it, see? I see it in a nice little envelope package. After, when he was done, he sat down on the mount, he called the disciples to him, he opened his mouth, he taught them, saying, I inserted the word truth there. He taught them the truth, saying, I want to tell you about the condition of the Lord's people. And consequently, you can pick it up in these verses, and then you can expand that even beyond that to some degree. Mr. Haig.
Verse 3, 4, 5, did you say that's the internal characteristic?
I think so, yes, I think so. But now, of course, obviously, when you get down later with a couple of these others, you see some internalisms too. So it's not, Mr. Dunswater would say, it's not mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive. It's weighted more in one direction and weighted less in another direction. Now, whether the Lord intended it that way or we are just overworking the text, I sometimes have wondered about those things. You know, the Lord will say something simple. We'll find 3 datives, 2 genitives, and an aorist in it, and have about a 400-pound sermon. And I sometimes have said, I wonder if the Lord really meant it that way. I've long felt that the use of the love verbs in John 21 was greatly overworked by evangelicals. It needs a piece or two. I just read that chapter yesterday again. If it had one or two other pieces, I'd think, you know, the agape, the agapao and phileo verses. At the risk of sounding, it doesn't even have anything to do with this course, but I've long thought that because the Lord uses agapao twice and then switches to phileo, but Peter uses phileo all three times. And so I've long said if Peter switched from phileo into agapao in the third usage, then I might think there was some calculated leaning on the words. But I'm prone to think there probably isn't. I'm prone to think the Lord changes the words to make him think, not to make him feel bad. Because I kind of feel if he had made him feel bad, then Peter would have gotten a clue from the Lord's first two years, and he would have said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I agapo. But he doesn't. He sticks with phileo to the end. It may be that when you're fishing, phileo is all you know. And in addition to that, when you do a word study through the Old and New Testament, you find that phileo is used a lot of times for a really deep, formative, personal love. And once... Beg your pardon? I don't know for sure. They're on the shore. I'd like to think that the Lord spoke Aramaic. I'm pretty sure he didn't speak Hebrew. He could have, but I'm pretty sure he didn't. How would I be sure? I just don't think he did. But they could have spoken anyone. They certainly were conversant in them. So what you get is the result of the translation. But the translation, I lean heavily on John 14, that the Holy Spirit would call to their minds what they ought to write. And so I think that the words that they wrote, even though they're coming from Hebrew to Greek, the Greek words reflect accurately what Jesus said. And of course, Hebrew has two or three words for love too, but they're not broken down like the agapa or phileo.
Mm-hmm. It's for that reason exactly that last week I mentioned that we have the voice of Jesus.
Not last week, the week before last.
Okay.
That
we have the voice of Jesus. Yes. In the words. Because I think very strongly that it's both impairment often.
Yeah. But that's, and I don't mean to kill this, but that's why I lean very heavily on the passage in John 14. Spirit will tell you what to write, and you'll write.
So
I don't think they were writing the words he said, but the meaning of those words is the Spirit led them.
That doesn't hurt my feelings.
No, it doesn't hurt mine either. In fact, what would really hurt us if we came on an Aramaic original. That would irritate us a little while. But I don't think we're going to do that. You could easily pick up Aramaic. It would take you, Mr. Dunlap, about 5 weeks to be, if you'll forgive me, to be as fluent in, I don't know where you are in Hebrew, but you were a good student. It would take you about 5 weeks to add to what you knew from Hebrew to make you feel comfortable in Aramaic. About 5 weeks. Maybe not in speaking it, but in reading it and knowing the grammar, because that's biblical Aramaic. You only need to add about 10 things to biblical Hebrew to have a pretty good grip of biblical Aramaic. There's some fine points you'd have to work on, but it's quite an easy transfer from biblical Hebrew to biblical Aramaic. It's a little different if you move from biblical Hebrew to commercial Aramaic. That's like moving from Koine Greek to regular Greek. You can work with it, but it's another story. Yeah, but that's what I kind of think that. So in that case, see, the words would be used intelligibly by John, even though they're Greek words. And whether they would work out of aha and amen in Hebrew or one of those things, I don't know for sure. But I am slow to preach on things like that. And the result is that a lot of people think I know no Greek at all. Sometimes I think that myself. But when you take a word, like agapao and find it a couple times it's used rather cheaply too, then it's difficult to say this is the word that always means the deep, abiding concept of everybody. I would say 7 times out of 10 it does that easily. And I mentioned to you the fellow who was writing a book on the tribulation question. He said, this word 18 times means such and such, but never told the people in the book that 21 times it meant something else. So he just gave him the feel that he used it, you know.
What do you think?
You know, I don't think I've read that. I don't think. Sorry. Probably should have. I haven't been a Lewis devotee, although I've read a lot of his stuff and enjoyed it. The problem was, if you're interested in my problem, I read the Screwtape Letters. I enjoyed it enormously. I read The Great Divorce, I bit my tongue several times, but I still enjoyed it. And then I read The Problem of Pain, in which Lewis shows a lot of humanism that I didn't enjoy hardly at all. Then I read The Case for Christianity. I think that's the right sequence, that I read them in. I again enjoyed that very much, and a few other things. But I never became a Lewis devotee. But I probably should have read that. It sounds like something I should have read. I did read this.
I've never heard of it.
No, I haven't read it. I did read his Brief Observed and a couple other things. Well, I think that can be done linguistically. The eros love, that term is never used in the New Testament, I think. The implications are there for it, certainly. But the term itself is never used. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's another one of those things. I did enjoy The Case for Christianity. I thought that was a great book. I've often given that away to people who were struggling with these, especially the great intellects, who usually... But that's a helpful book, I think. But I bit my lip on The Problem of Pain, I think, studying the Psalms. I bit my lip on it a couple of times. It was a great day for me when I learned that not everybody would say things exactly the way I said them. And that, I mean, among true Christians, which I certainly think Lewis is a true Christian. And that if they didn't say it exactly the way I said it, at least I could bite my lip. So what they say in life, by the time you get mellow, the next stage is getting rotten. Like fruit. Who knows where we'll be next. But that's the structure that I like to see for those things. Oh, those were asterisks. Those were asterisks. I'm not sure why I put them there, except I'm going down the chart. And I said to myself on my note sheet, it says, be sure to mention that this is the 4-4. This ends the collocation. Yeah. And this thing
right here
is just a bad. Just a blot on my screen. Just a blot on my screen. Good question, though, Mr. A. I often mark stuff so that I'll remember it. And then I ought to go over and remake those remarks after I write up the class notes, but a lot of times I don't, because I use these on the funniest stuff. Occasionally a picture of Donald Duck. Well, I'll say nothing more background sense. Let's look at the introductory thought in Matthew 5. What Bible versions do we have in this class? IV, NIV?
New American Standard.
NIV. We don't have anything besides New American Standard, the NIV, and the King James. Is that right? Okay. You're welcome to use whatever Bible, and the Greek text. I'll leave mine over there.
Greek.
If you'd like, yeah. The Vulgate is much easier Latin than many people assume. So no Latin is easy. Latin makes, a year of Latin makes Greek seem easy. No Latin is easy. But I don't know if I've ever read the sermon on the Vulgate. Read all of John in the Vulgate and a couple of things like that, but I don't think I've ever read the sermon on that. But be sure if you bring it in, it's the Clementine edition, because that's what I have. Seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. When he was set, his disciples came unto him. He opened his mouth and he taught them, saying. I don't think there's a great deal to be said there, unless you want to make a lot of emotional pleas and, for the way in which we teach and the way in which we do. I've always taken the expression, when he was set, you know, just when he put himself down, when he was in a proper position to do these particular things. I think that there were more than just the disciples present. Some scholars have tried to argue in verse 1, that only the disciples were there. And the fact that they were there was the fact he drew away from Melchizedek, having seated himself. The disciples of him came to him. That's quite literally in your Greek text, Mr. Hay, quite literally. They came to him, the disciples of him. So some have said that Jesus saw a great crowd, and he said, you can't do anything with a bunch like this, just Koine language. So he went up in the mountains and sat down, and then his disciples left the multitude and came there and stood around. So many have said that the Sermon on the Mount was given only to the disciples who followed him into the mount. I personally don't agree with that, but I don't have any argument. I personally think the disciples were right there in front of him. It's hard for me to believe the disciples could sneak away from the crowd unless God translated them. The crowd knowing who they were and knowing who he was. It's hard for me to believe it. But I kind of think he was set there, and the disciples were in immediate presence, and beyond them were aspects of the crowd. That's what I kind of think. Mrs. Mitchell.
It's in a sense,
That's right. That's right. And of course, I think what happened was that the longer he talked, the more the people came. And I've had friends that said, well, they would have pressed him for healings, but the truth is the disciples made like a... I can see it beautifully in my mind's eye. I can see him sitting on a rock in a crevice, and the disciples sitting in front of him. And unless the crowd had stomped them to death, the crowd fills up the mountains behind him. But they listened clearly. The Lord certainly had a good voice, and it echoes. See how the imagination goes? It echoes to them out of the sound chamber of the mountain behind him. And they could hear him distinctly a long way off. That's highly imaginative. It might not be right. But that they heard him, that's right. Because at the end, they said, nobody teaches like this. So I've long thought that there was a great group there. And by the same token, I've always felt that the bulk of it was intended for the disciples and for those who were really his. That it's not essentially an evangelistic discourse, although it touches on the truth in chapter 7. But for those who would hear chiefly, his disciples needed it desperately. Because in the life of a disciple, it's very easy to get your eyes and attention on wrong things. You'll remember later in the Gospels, Peter says to him, he said, Lord, he said, we've left all of... When the Lord says, like, nobody can, unless he's willing to give up his wife, his home, and follow me, and so forth. And Peter says, well, we have left all and followed you. And the implication is, what do we get? It isn't exactly said, but the implication. And the Lord says to him, he says, no man who's left all and followed me will be the lacker for. He'll have great blessings in heaven and much more in this life also. So I kind of think that the heart of the disciples, and those that also believed on him, who stood to have a life in comparison with others that was less than materialistically satisfied. The Son of Man has no place to lay his head. The foxes have dens. And I think they were faced with that. So I think what he's saying to them is, if you're my real people, then you've got to be prepared to understand some of these truths. And the first thing you have to understand is what your character is. So in verse 3. In verse 3, stop me if there's anything you want to add. But in verse 3, he says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Big fights rage about this. Dr. Harris thought that the expression in spirit, for those who have studied Greek, Dr. Harris thought I don't know if he thought it seriously, or if he just thought it to make us think. And I never got a chance to ask him really. But Dr. Harris thought the in spirit ought to be taken as a locative of spear, rather than a datum of reference. Every commentary you will read will take as the datum of reference, meaning, blessed are those who are poor with reference to the spirit. And Dr. Harris said, I prefer, don't know if he still thinks this or not, he said, I prefer that you read it, blessed are the poor in the realm of spirit. Put a comma in there. Blessed in the spirit are the poor. You see a difference in those two? Yeah, sure. Well, that's what Dr. Harris liked. The problem with it is, I suppose, is even he quickly admitted, is that there's not much supporting grammatical construction to argue for a locative of sphere. You could say dative of sphere. We used to work under the old Robertson 8-case system. So you could say, if you work with Mason, you'd say a dative of sphere. Dative meaning in the place in which you find it. And Dr. Harris, I think, would freely say that there were not enough examples of datives, locatives, a sphere used that way. Whereas there are beaucoup examples of datives of reference. Blessed are the poor with reference to their spirit. So I, you know, when I get caught between great minds, I do what anyone does. I kind of see which one is talking the loudest and get in his corner, or something like that. I'm prone to think that probably the dative of reference is right. The poor with reference to spirit, blessed are they. And that's why, as I said earlier, Mr. Garrish, I think in Luke, that the poor stand out, the demonstrative type thing. But you stop and you say to yourself, first, what is blessed? I'm almost off this overhead, but don't feel unnerved. I have six more. First, what is blessed? What's blessed? The word blessed, makarioi, the word blessed, makarioi, it's amazing how average congregations are impressed by just speaking a Greek word now and then. I personally don't do it. If I'm going to give a lesson and people can study with me, then I can do it. I guess I'm not confident, but I personally don't do it because I think it's pedantic. It just bugs people. It impresses them. And I remember being at a conference. Any of you PCB men? Or women? Help women PCB. Well, I went to a conference several years ago just to listen to guys preach. One of these fellows was they were both good preachers. One of them was a graduate of a Bible school. And the other one was Dr. Carlene from PCB. whose doctor's degree is in comparative linguistics and Greek Hellenistic literature and all that kind of stuff. The fellow from Bible school, he might have had a lot of Greek, but I doubt it. They don't give a lot of Greek at Bible school. He had a good message. But he must have made 20 references to Greek in the course of his message, including several poorly pronounced words. He must have made at least 20. And Dr. Carlene, his doctor's degree in the field, never mentioned it once. You can see the fruit of his study. And that's what I like to see. I like when I can see the fruit of a guy's study without him looking out and saying, now the Arabic word is such and such, and I'm sorry that you dummies don't know the Arabic word. Nobody really says it that way, but it can really come out that way if you're not careful pretty well. And you learn that when somebody says to you later, they want to ask you a question, they say, well, I'm sorry, I don't know the Greek. Well, that's right. That's why we have experts in the church. But anyhow, the concept of makarioi, its classical usage, my classical dictionary says, quote, is intended to show a transcendent happiness of life beyond care, labor, and death. That's what my classical Greek dictionary says. The makarioi in its classical usage is intended to show a transcendent happiness of life beyond care, labor, and death. That's quite a happiness, see? A transcendent, that means it comes down upon you. It's given by God or by some force outside yourself. You don't buy it at the Acme. It comes on you and you're delivered from care. I'm sorry, you're delivered from the normal care, the labor. You still go out and work. But the things that aggravate your soul and the things that put you in fear of death and the things that fill you with care, you're free from those things. And they say in classical Greek, that's what makarioi indicates. In the Old Testament, it translates the Hebrew word ashrei, ashrei, ashrei. It translates the Hebrew word ashrei in the Old Testament, which just for the sake of fun looks like this. Ashrei. And in the Old Testament, it's usually translated happiness because we don't quite know how to translate it. It's translated blessedness, too. It's used in Psalm 32, oh, the blessedness of the man. And it's used in Psalm 1. It's used in the Old Testament, it's usually translated blessedness or happiness, but again it indicates a state of life which is delivered from the things that otherwise harass us. Mr. Gerrish.
That's the word used in Psalm 1, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And in Psalm 32, and throughout the Psalter, to indicate, and in the Old Testament in general, Moses used it a lot too, to indicate a state that comes upon you where you're delivered, like in Psalm 1, from all those bad guys. Yeah, so makarioi is the Greek word that translates that. It does it in the Septuagint all the time. And, of course, it's not translated in the New Testament. We think it's been used in the New Testament the way it was in the Old. Mr. Hay.
Does the ashrei imply a kind of favor from God?
Well, somehow you've been favored from God so that you escape the snare of those of the wicked and whatnot in Psalm 1, and you escape the penalty of your sin in Psalm 32. Without God, you couldn't have it. And that's why the classical dictionary uses the word transcend.
I don't want to end up in Carson's book, but I was told the same thing you're saying now with contrast you would have, because that's more of a spoken kind of blessedness, when you say something good about someone else, whereas this is just thing with the mindset, you don't buy it down.
Well, you won't wind up in Carson's book, you won't even wind up in my book. Carson's book is a pretty good book. I enjoyed it. I think Carson and my friend at Westminster sometimes both, I think, understate the significance of individual words, because I believe the individual words are chosen intelligently to convey aspects. But I also believe at other times that they are synonymous with the point where you can't do. So it's a mistake to build a theology on words that way. But I think they neglect it terribly. You know, when I look at someone and say, my, you look nice, I mean something different than when I look at them and say, you're beautiful. I would say, you're nice, you look nice, a nice suit, a nice tie. But I'm not going to call you beautiful in 50 years. Maybe handsome later on. Is it beautifully?
What book is that by Carson?
Exegetical Fallacy. Yeah. It'll ruin a lot of things. If you haven't read it, you need to read it.
I read it.
Yeah. That's right. Of course, his colleagues did not totally agree with him in Trinity. Kaiser thinks he's almost... I wasn't thinking about Watke. I was thinking about the fellow who wrote the book. Silva, yeah.
So,
well, I think he's a great scholar. I've enjoyed his stuff. and I enjoyed his book too, but I think they tend to minimize the exactness of choice. You know, there's a funny thing in Galatians. Now, how this I think is probably Greek. Paul says, he said, not to seeds as to many, but to seed as to one. You know, the apostle is really making a big case on the simple fact that the word is singular, not plural. Yeah. Hey, we better quit. Hate to stop. Well, that's not true. It's hard for me to tell the truth today. But I do enjoy talking the text. And we'll do this for the next several days, so you be ready to join in and offer your contributions.